Hello and welcome to Root Causes, the PKI and security podcast where two industry veterans talk about all matters PKI, including cryptography, certificates, trust models, and things along those lines. I am Tim Callen, senior fellow at SigTigo, and I am joined, as always, by Jason Sirocco, CTO of IoT at SigTigo. How are you doing today, Jay?
Doing great, Tim, and I'm trying to write down right here with a pencil a new acronym I'm going to coin, which is just another quantum podcast.
Just another Yes, just another quantum podcast. We once again are returning to the topic of quantum resistant cryptography. It is a fascinating topic. It's something that I've been researching a lot. We've been discussing a lot. We've been writing about a lot. There's been a lot going on. And in particular, I wanted today to return to the concept of Mosca's inequality. So we did a whole podcast on Mosca's inequality earlier, and I can look up the podcast number and say that for you, but you can go back and have a look. And we sort of defined the basics of it, but I think there's a lot more subtlety and nuance that we didn't have a chance to get into. And I think it's probably stuff that's important and matters. So I was hoping we would get into it today. So for starters, maybe Jay, just let's ground everybody. In essence, what is the point behind Mosca's inequality?
Sure. It is really, are we up the creek or not? Is the question being asked. And it's really the difference between two times, two very specific times, which is, it's going to take a certain amount of time to come up with a quantum resistant algorithm that everybody say, you know, gives the thumbs up to.
Right.
Just like we have RSA and ECC today, we need new algorithms in the future. And I know that NIST is working on that. In fact, we did another whole podcast just on that topic.
We did.
So it's going to take a certain amount of time. It's also going to take a certain amount of time for quantum computers themselves, general quantum computers, to be able to have enough stable qubits to then threaten the traditional algorithms that we're using today. And so that date is what is quite often referred to as the Z date or the Z date. And that entire concept that I just tried to rhyme off is what I think we often refer to as Mosca's inequality, because quite often it's Michaela Mosca, yeah, who actually from the University of Waterloo, who has been the most vocal and I think coined a lot of these terms.
Yeah, and so Mosca's inequality, Michaela Mosca actually used some different words, but I've seen in a lot of writing online, people have substituted out his original variables for X, Y, and Z. And so basically you would write it X plus Y question mark equals Z, where X is what you just said, right? It's the time to discover new algorithms and retool to be able to have those algorithms deployed in the real wide world. Y is the time your data needs to remain secure after the last day of using the old cryptography. So I'll give you a really easy example. I have a credit card in my wire in my wallet that expires on February 2020. So on March 2020, the number of that credit card is of no value, right? So that is the time horizon for that data. And so the question you ask is, what's the time horizon for your data beyond which it's no longer interesting, right? We start with the assumption that 100 years from now, nobody's going to care about what our files is in our files today. Well, what's the point at which they stop caring? And that kind of becomes your Y value. And then your Z value, your Z value, as you said, is the amount of time until quantum computing beats the old crypto. And so this winds up, this X plus Y equals Z equation gets thrown around and people think about it that way and they go, well, how long is X and how long is Y? And I believe, and I'm not criticizing Mosca, I think this is a hugely important concept. I believe that the way that we deal with it in some ways is oversimplified and is not gonna address how we're actually going to have to deal with these things in the real world when the time comes, and the time is coming soon. And so let me give you a few examples of this, if I may, Jay.
Yeah, this is interesting, Tim. You're throwing down the gauntlet here. It's great.
So X is the time to discover and deploy, retool the new algorithms. Let's actually break that into two pieces. I'm going to call that X1 and X2, where X1 is the time to discover algorithms. And NIST has suggested that 2022 is probably the deadline. We talk about NIST in our episode 36 in this. So go listen to our episode 36. And by the way, we discuss Moscow's inequality in our episode 35. So that's good baseline for this. So X1 is the amount of time NIST suggests 2022. This is 2019 right now. So let's say that's 3 years from now. X2 is the amount of time for the rollout. And so I think we can break down both of these subtly, and what we're going to see is that it's really there's range. So first of all, 2022, in and of itself, that's a whole year. There's a year's difference between January 1 and December 31st of 2022. And in the kind of timeframes we're talking about, that's actually quite a bit. So right there, we've got a lot of looseness in that particular estimate. And I know that it's hard. I appreciate that it's hard, but you know, it's not the simple 3 years that we talk about. But then when we look to X2, the rollout time, I think that the range there is going to be incredibly broad. So I'll give you a few examples. TLS certs. TLS certs are limited right now to 27 months. There was recently a vote in the CA browser forum to try to limit them to 397 days. By 2022, that limitation may have come about. So a TLS, and they're not going to get longer. So at a bare minimum, you know that in 27 months, 100% of your TLS certs will have been swapped out. That's your degree of crypto agility. Now, on the other hand, let's think about some kind of IoT device that's deployed in the field, that is far away and hard to get to. How long might that device last, Jay, without any material change happening to it?
I'm thinking automobile. It's not unexpected to think of it as a 10 to 15 year device. You know, airplanes right, being into the 20 to 30 year range. And there will be devices in industrial control systems that'll be 30 plus.
Right. So we've got some devices that are going to, some certs are going to be swapped out in 2 years or 1 year or less. Some certs are going to be swapped out in 30. So right there, the amount of range we're saying is really incredible. The other thing is that not all organizations are going to be the same. So you're going to have some organizations that are going to be on it. They're going to be on it because they have very deep security requirements, or they have strong compliance requirements, or they just are very seriously attractive targets. You can think about who this might be, right? This might be a three-letter agency from the government, or this might be a major financial institution. And they're just going to be really determined to get this cryptography done quickly. On the other hand, there will be other organizations that are not going to be nearly so on it. And so my case study, and this is the Debian OpenSSL flaw. So a little bit of background for people. Back in maybe, I'm going to guess 2010, 2009, I could look that up. It turned out that there was a very severe flaw discovered in the OpenSSL implementation for the Debian flavor of Linux. And as a consequence, the keys were completely predictable. And this was huge news when it happened. And all of the CAs scrambled to get these things swapped out. And some people swapped them out right away. There were people who literally replaced their certs the next day. They saw the headlines and they went and replaced their certs. But there were still Debian certs floating around 3 years later. So we saw a broad range of responsiveness in terms of the certificate holders. Some certificate holders were very quick and they got really on it. And some certificate holders just weren't.
Right, Tim. And we see this in a lot of manner. When it comes to SSL, I think sure, that because of the CAB form rules, the CAs typically got to get on things quick. There's not really much of a choice. And I don't think any of the CAs are lazy at that. You know, they do a pretty good job. Right? I could be wrong, you know, in some edge cases, but for the most part, that is the case. But you're right in saying that there's certificates everywhere, yeah, and they're not always, they're not always treated the same way. And I think I know where you're going with this. Okay. This wide range of not just certificate lifetimes, but certificate usages.
Yeah, exactly. And so one of the things we do, we say, well, what is X? And we come up with a number. We go, okay, well, it took 10 years to swap out ECC, and it's going to take 3 years to get to the new post-quantum algorithms. I'm going to add those together and I'm going to say 13 years. Well, okay. Maybe if you're taking blended averages, that works. But in the real world, it's not really going to be about blended averages. It's going to be about lots and lots and lots of individual use cases and what happens in those use cases. And if my information gets stolen and I'm in a breach, I don't care if lots of other people weren't in breaches. That doesn't help me. What helps me is that I was in a breach. And so there's a big difference between getting some systems switched over or even getting the majority of Swiss systems switched over and getting ubiquity of the new algorithms. And in fact, Jay, we just recently podcasted about a major breach that was due to the fact that somebody was still protecting passwords on SHA-1.
Oh, the usage of older algorithms is, it definitely is a problem. SHA-1 is the poster child for that right now.
Right. So that's one thing that I think discussion, kind of academic discussion of Mosca's inequality seems to be missing is that, you know, the real world ubiquitous deployment task is incredibly hard. And some of it's hard just because of compliance. It's hard just because of getting people to do it. So, you know, that's subtle point number one that I really wanted to talk about is the range of responses. Some will be very quick, some will be very slow, some will be probably never.
Yeah. So, Tim, I'd like to see then what you would do with the equation, because the equation right now is pretty simple.
Yeah, and it's got to be simple. I think it's just a more of a matter of us thinking. And so let me get to that. I want to carp on why a little while we're at it. So why, right? What is why? Why is the time your data needs to remain secure? Well, we just saw from a case study I gave us that that is a variable number. So my credit card and CVV that's going to expire on February 1 of 2020 has it's September right now. So that has a 4-month lifespan, right? Why for that is 4 months. However, there are other pieces of information where Y could be very long, right? If I'm getting somebody's PII or personal health information, that could be sensitive for decades to come. If I'm getting industrial or state secrets, that could be sensitive for decades to come. So once again, putting a simple number on it is really hard, right? Mosca himself suggested, why don't we go with 7 years? Because that is a very common business retention requirement. And, right, you know, a sensible person trying to be sensible about it, that is a good thing to plug a number into the equation. But let's all remember that that's only part of it, right? If for some pieces of data that really matter, it may already be too late, right? If there's something, you know, if there's a state secret that still needs to be secret 20 years from now, it's too late. It's game over.
So Tim, this is just going to be my response to what you've said.
Right.
And it's pretty simple, which is, I think this is the way it's meant to work anyway, at this stage of the game, which is, I think the work at the academic level by Michaela Mosca and others who have also, you know, postulated on the exact same topic.
Right.
I think what's happening now is the operational realities outside of the academic circles are now, you know, responding to this.
Yeah.
And this is you, a bona fide expert in the public trust world, looking at this and really thinking about it hard and going, hey, there's more to this.
Hey, what are the brass tacks going to mean? Right. And it's messy. And as so often happens in these things, right? You can have some simple concepts that when you get out into the broad, varied, ubiquitous, just the teeming myriad of real world implementations, clean naturally becomes messy. It's unavoidable. And this is some of what we're happening here. And again, I'm not criticizing. I think it's really good to have this model. I just think as we engage with this model, we need to understand that the model and the world are not necessarily going to be the same.
Tim, I think you're absolutely right. It had to start simple in order to start off the conversation, you know, to get NIST, to get the ball rolling.
Right.
It had to be simple to get us to start thinking about it and talking about it.
Yes.
I don't think Mosca's inequality goes anywhere. I think it remains a pillar that we're going to stand on, but we need to start building on top of it. And I think that's what
it's an important foundation. It's a great way to think about things. And Musk is definitely smarter than I am, so I'm not pretending otherwise. But you know, as we get into this, right, this is some of what we need to do to refine these concepts. And even Z, right, the Z date also isn't a single date. I could propose a number of Z dates. So Z1 would be the first time any actor in the world was ever capable of breaking RSA and ECC. And by the way, it's possible that when Z1 rolls around, we don't know. There's what I'm going to call Z2, which is that it's common that well-resourced actors, such as a nation or a high-income criminal organization, can break RSA and ECC. And then there's what I call Z3, which is any script kiddie can break RSA and ECC. And those are three distinct dates that are absolutely not going to be the same.
Well, for sure. And even when you listen to the academics themselves, I've listened to enough of Mosca's work as well as others and read conference papers and been in attendance at these things to know typically, some of them have given dates, but typically, and Mikola Musk himself typically will give a statistical range. In other words, right, you know, 1 in 7 chance by a date, sure, which is more of a statistical range.
Right. And it recognizes so much of the fuzziness and the unsurety of a lot of this. So, you know, but that's another way to think about it, right? And then the last thing connected to that, of course, is that RSA and ECC aren't going to be broken at the exact same time, right? They're based on different mathematical functions, and though both mathematical functions are vulnerable to the specifics of quantum computing, they're not going to be equally vulnerable. They're not going to be vulnerable at the same pace. And you and I just did a podcast wondering if quantum annealing was going to accelerate the Z date for RSA. And that could be a way that we see a lot of difference between RSA and ECC in terms of when they're deemed to be untrustworthy.
Yeah, in fact, Tim, the mathematical difference between RSA and ECC are interesting in that, of course, RSA being prime-based,
right,
ECC being based on an interesting fact of geometry.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, RSA has a much larger bit length than the current implementations of ECC, which are advantageous from an operational standpoint, not advantageous from a Shor's algorithm vulnerability standpoint. So
yeah,
there's so much here. And Tim, our last podcast on this was the fact that, you know, people have been raising interesting questions about quantum annealing and whether or not, you know, that's just an entirely different way of doing business here, and whether, you know, Shor's algorithm on a classical, or sorry, Shor's algorithm on a full quantum computer, you know, is that going to be the thing that does it, which is most of what we've been talking about, or are there better forms of mathematics and better forms of operationalizing what's the nature of different types of quantum computers? Yeah. This is not a simple subject, and heck, just in the last year or two, Tim, we've seen some significant breakthroughs in math,
yeah,
that are pushing us further and further ahead. So,
yeah,
you know, so some of those eureka moments you and I talked about are...
We've talked about the eureka moments. You're absolutely right. And, you know, and identifying quantum annealing as a possible attack vector actually, I think, qualifies as an example of a eureka moment. And there may be others. So yeah, then there's that, of course, which is, are we just fundamentally misunderstanding the landscape of how quantum computers will progress and how they'll be used? And these things never take longer than you think, right? They only move faster, if anything. And so, you know, it's just interesting. I like the idea of all of us thinking broadly about these concepts and not getting too comfortable that, oh, I know one number and it's 10, and I know a number, then another number and it's 3, and those add to 13, and then my third number is 15, and that's great because that means we're all fine, right? I just think let's not get comfortable with that as a concept, because none of these numbers is exact, and none of these numbers is even exactly known. And so every one of these things is a curve, every one of these things is fuzzy, and every one of these things is going to vary a lot based on use case, actor, and algorithm. And that's an important thing.
Thankfully, Tim,
to remember.
A lot of what you've been talking here about today is the essentially the attack side, the offensive side to this, which is obviously where a lot of research, you know, is being done. It's going to have to, because the commercial pressures, we talked about this before, the commercial pressures for quantum computing are significant.
Yes.
You know, artificial intelligence, deep learning, all these kinds of things will be enhanced massively by quantum computers. So it's inevitable, it's coming. So for those of us in the CA business and those of us who issue X509 certificates with cryptographic algorithms of today, I think there's thankfully, you know, an enormous amount of work being done from that side as well. So, you know, I always want to leave these podcasts with the slightly happier story of the fact that, you know, we're on it. And as Tim says, people who are extremely smart, especially on the math side, are working feverishly at this just as hard as the other side. So it's all good.
You bet we are. And part of the way to solve it properly, I think, is to take a properly sophisticated and nuanced look at the problem. And again, I know lots of people are. I think when you look at the discussion kind of in the mainstream, it's very oversimplified. And it's not bad for us to make sure that we're communicating the nuances behind this as well. And so thank you for indulging me. No. I think we've done that.
So for those of you who aren't Tim Callan listening to this, which includes me and everybody else, you know, Tim, thank you very much for that, because you're an important voice in the public trust business. You're helping to highlight the fact that it could be tempting to oversimplify this. I'm coming at it from the standpoint of the academics had to oversimplify it,
right?
And I think that the kind of thinking you're doing right now is exactly what we should be doing to get a better grasp on what the risks really, really are.
Yeah, and this is what industry is going to have to do, right? Industry, there are some people who are really, really, really good at math and cryptography are going to have to help us understand what are the new algorithms. Then there's a whole different community of people who's going to have to help us understand how do we make this really be in effect in the real world. And it is not too soon for us to be having those conversations.
Yeah, the operational aspect of this is very interesting. There's stuff going on, Tim, that, you know, I'll be announcing with you in the near future, but stay tuned to this story.
So stay tuned. Thank you, everybody. Thank you, Jay.
Thank you so much,
Tim. And of course, this is Root Causes.